Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory, paint the breeze.
Among the birthdays today, very interesting, since we're very defense-oriented, and that's on our mind with the terrorism, and of course we're not talking about domestic terrorism. Charles Wilson, the president of General Motors, was appointed Secretary of Defense in the Dwight Eisenhower administration, and he got into a lot of trouble when he made the statement and was misinterpreted. He said, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. What he meant was that General Motors was involved in so many industries. They used to make refrigerators, all their car division, Chevy, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, GMC trucks, Buick. Buick used to be called the banker's car, plus Delco Remy, and then they were involved with the DuPont Company of Delaware, which was the French Huguenot, had its sources in France in the 17th century. The U.S. Justice Department had a long, ongoing federal court battle to try to divest General Motors from its interests and DuPont's interest in General Motors. And I think it took about 15, 20 years to resolve that. But Charles Wilson, when he made that statement, everybody jumped on him who didn't know, you know, the impact that General Motors has had on the American economy. And, of course, during World War II, they were involved in military equipment to fight the war. Among the other interesting people born today and talking about World War II, we don't talk too much about the Japanese in Canada. Well, of course, I had done some work for the Japanese-American Civil Rights League, and in the wake of the Aquino case, Tokyo Rose, or Rose D'Aquino, she married a Filipino named D'Aquino, and she was an American born in Los Angeles, and the tradition then, and it's not so much now as far as I know, was that the firstborn children of Japanese immigrants, sensei, were sent to Japan to absorb the culture. They still had this Japanese superiority, I guess you could call it, mentality. She got caught over there. Her passport was screwed up. She got caught over there with some other girls and American citizens and at the outbreak of Pearl Harbor, and she couldn't get this passport thing straightened out. She was stranded. So the Japanese secret police and Tojo's government forced her and others, including an Australian, to do broadcasts. There were about 20 women, but the name of the show was Tokyo Rose. And the horrible thing that happened to her, they told her, if you don't broadcast, you go to the concentration camp or we'll execute you. Here's a 20-year-old graduate of UCLA, who didn't know the culture. And the brutal tactics of the Kempeitai. Anyway, her case, she was targeted by, after the war, first thing that the military intelligence did was try to locate her when MacArthur landed in Tokyo. So she happened to be at the radio station, the wrong place at the wrong time and the unfortunate time. And the Hearst papers, Walter Winchell, a corrupt journalist, and we'll get into that, or corrupt media person, I don't even call him a journalist, was beating the war drums for her arrest, trial, and execution. The Justice Department initially looked at the record, and they said it was a very weak case. So they finally succumbed to the political and media pressure, and the rule was at that time on jurisdiction, federal jurisdiction, that an American who betrays the country or is accused of acts against the United States, when apprehended, was supposed to be brought to the nearest federal court district, which in this case would have been Honolulu, Hawaii. But since there were so many Japanese and Asians there, they decided she would get a fair trial and she'd be acquitted. So they chose San Francisco, which still had the hostility toward the Japanese. Horrible things happened here. It's one of the things George Christopher didn't talk about when I did all my interviews with him. Anyway, she was tried here in San Francisco by a judge who happened to, another one like Kevin Ryan, who emigrated from Ireland. I guess this judge was Irish, or he was a legal immigrant, was also a deputy district attorney like Ryan, and he railroaded her. And so she was sentenced to 10 years and $5,000 fine in federal prison and a $5,000 fine. She was later, we tried to get her pardoned, the American Civil Liberties Union and others, and I worked on that part of the try to get her pardon. And then I met her years later in Chicago under the name Toguri, which was her family name. But that's what's interesting about. Now, getting back to the Japanese in Canada, they were also put in camps. There weren't as many. Of course, there are a lot more there now. But today is S.I. Hayakawa's birthday. He was the guy who made famous by wearing the tam. He was the president of San Francisco State University in 1968, and I was working here in San Francisco before I returned to college. And I remember the riots, and he was made famous by pulling the plugs out of the radical students' loudspeakers. And that picture was flashed around the world, and he ran for U.S. Senate. Well, it's quite interesting that he had come to Chicago just before the war, and he was not interned with other Japanese. He worked for a black newspaper, the Chicago Defender. A lot of this is not known. So he escaped internment. And later he married an American Caucasian woman, a white woman, had kids, and they became radicals and went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon. It's quite interesting. Hayakawa is dead now, but today is his birthday, and that's and he wrote a book on semantics. He was a professor of semantics and also a journalist who worked for the black newspaper, the Chicago Defender. Also today, this is another San Francisco has a connection. Andrei Gromyko was the foreign minister. He survived all the purges in the Stalin and Bulganin, Khrushchev, and I think Kosygin administrations in Soviet Russia. And George Christopher, when he was invited by Khrushchev to go to Russia, he did meet Gromyko, and Gromyko had misled him, and he told Gromyko, "Don't lie to me." we talked back to Gromyko. Gromyko was flummoxed. We'll get into that another time. And getting back to related things with the Russians, John Glenn, during the Kennedy administration, was one of our first astronauts. He was from Ohio. He was a Marine Corps colonel. And he was also a U.S. senator representing the Democratic Party from Ohio. Another, well, I guess you could call him a journalist, Hunter S. Thompson was born today, and he's most famous for his burnout, I guess it was on drugs. Fear and Loathing is probably known about him. He coined the phrase, I guess, and enough said about Thompson. And then among the deaths today was Horatio Alger, which was the theme that young boys were indoctrinated with. If they worked hard, they could become wealthy, and hard work and grit would make them American success stories. He died today in 1899. An actor who really never got his due, he was never knighted. I always liked him. He had this gravelly voice. Jack Hawkins died today. You can remember him playing the role of Field Marshal Allenby in Lawrence of Arabia. He was also in several other films with his gravelly voice. A great actor who died very young, 62 years old. Among the events today, we had the burning of Rome, and of course, if you want to see the great play, the great movie with Nero, he plays his fiddle. Peter Ustinov played the role of Nero, and he's strumming his, not his fiddle, but his harp, and he's playing the composer. And this, I think Robert Taylor and Gene Simmons, is not mistaken, was also in that film about the crucifixion of St. Peter. And, of course, it is now revealed that Nero didn't start the fire, but he's blamed for it in AD 64. The first transcontinental railroad was not the one at Promontory Point in 1863 during the Abraham Lincoln administration. It was 1853. The Grand Trunk Railroad was the first continental American railroad and was completed at that time. And then jumping forward to 1936, we had the Spanish Civil War was started with Franco. And, of course, a lot of the left, the American communists and the left, went to fight for the Popular Front in Spain. And it was quite a war. Out of this Spanish Civil War, Pablo Picasso, after the Germans practiced tactics, especially with their Luftwaffe and their Condor Legion, and they bombed the town, flattened it, Guernica. And that's one of the most famous of Pablo Picasso's paintings. Incidentally, there's a rare, people are still asking the question, what is that statue or that sculpture in downtown Chicago that looks like a lot of things? Well, that sculpture is was put there, placed there in 1968. I do remember it because I was covering the Democratic Convention at that time. And it is of Pablo Picasso's Afghan Hound. We have a rare picture of Pablo Picasso's dogs, and we have that Afghan hound named Kabul, K-A-B-U-L, after the town in Afghanistan. We have his exhibitions going around San Francisco, going around part of the country, I think, and it's here in San Francisco. And, of course, a lot of the left and the communists, Burgess and McLean and Philby, all fought in that war, and then you had the Americans who were, the American contingent was over there fighting against, quote, the fascists. Franco was one of the also one of the longest lived and survived dictators in modern history. He was only surpassed by a guy named, I think, Salazar in Portugal, which is next door. They had there's a rare movie that we acquired. Which covers the military uprising. It was a peaceful uprising. There was no shooting, which is interesting, in Portugal, which overthrew the last of the Portuguese dictators, and they became socialists. Also, the horrible things that the Portuguese did in Angola and Mozambique, which were Portuguese territories. Portugal also was one of the last countries to abolish the slave trade or stop the slave trade. It was one of the worst countries with the Inquisition. We hear about the Spanish Inquisition. The Portuguese was much worse. We'll get into that another time. Also today, 1932, the United States and Canada signed a treaty to start work on the St. Lawrence Seaway. However, the Depression and World War II interrupted that, and General Philip Berrigan, United States Army, graduate of West Point, military engineer. We have his rare interview. I don't think there's he never talked about his role in it, and I met him here in San Francisco, and we will replay that later this week about the whole thing, how it was done. Also, the first electric power was generated from atomic energy today. I think it might have been in England. I'm still trying to run that down. And in 1984, Walter Mondale, where's the beef, was the selected by the Democratic National Convention here in San Francisco to be the their standard bearer for the 1984 election. And of course, Mondale said that and he selected Geraldine Ferraro, whose husband was sleazy, that he would raise taxes, and he said, "Read my lips," and all of that. I think it was George Bush who said, "Read my lips," and but George Walter Mondale said that, you know, "I won't lie to you, and I will raise taxes," but he was still defeated at the ballot box. Now, the Mondale is very interesting. He's from Minnesota, part of that Democratic labor farm movement up there, successors, part of Hubert Humphrey's legacy. And how he became famous is quite interesting. His Scandinavian background, it was Mundale, I think it was Norwegian family. And a lot of Scandinavians anglicized their names also. For instance, the one-time police chief of Chicago was a professor at Berkeley, Orlando W. Wilson, was also Scandinavian. I think he was a Swedish ethnicity, a heritage. That's correct. Also, the late Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court and Governor of California during World War II, Earl Warren, he was of Scandinavian heritage. So we have a lot of these people. Anyway, Mondale, this is how he became a senator and became the standard bearer. While he was going to school, I think for law school, he worked at Green Giant packing plant. And then he graduated and went into the Minnesota Attorney General's office. A big charitable scandal started in Minneapolis. There was a Sister Kenny Polio Foundation. Now, that's not a religious name. Now, the British and the Commonwealth peoples refer to nurses as sister, there's no religious connotation. So Sister Kenny had come up with developed a method to restore action to the use of limbs of people who had polio. And so they started this huge foundation in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Well, there were many scandals like there are with a lot of these organizations, especially the AIDS organization today. And so the Minnesota Attorney General was investigating. Well, the head of the top dog in the Minnesota Attorney General's office was a guy named, I forgot his name. Anyway, he was appointed a federal judge who later handled a major case involving women's device that was causing women problems. Female problems, I think cancer and that. Anyway, so Mondale was the top deputy. He was catapulted to the position of Minnesota's attorney general, and he got the credit for the work that his predecessor had done. So he later ran for Senate and became a senator from Minnesota about the same time as Eugene McCarthy, who I worked for, was one of the volunteers in 1968 because we were opposed to the war. And then later on, he was selected by Carter to be a vice presidential nominee down there in Plains, Georgia. And then, of course, in 1984, he was selected by the party bigwigs in San Francisco. And then he selected Geraldine Ferraro, who was the first woman to be nominated for vice president. So that's his story, quite famous. And then of course I think he's dead. I'm not sure, but his children seem like a lot of children seem of popular figures, or prominent figures, excuse me, seem to get into trouble. But you know that's the way it is. So that's the Mondale story. Also today, let me get back to some of the things that are important. The media is having a great time bashing Murdoch and his interests, and actually there are questions about where did Murdoch get all his money for all these publications, and it turns out it may have come from the Chinese. Anyway, it's a bad scandal in England, and it's spreading because some of that hacking was done either over here or on Americans. However, America has its own media moron scandal, and it dates back in our time, or in this century, to Jake Lingle, L-I-N-G-L-E, who was he was on the payroll not only of Al Capone, which people didn't know at the time, during the Prohibition period in Chicago, but also he was a reporter who never did anything for the Chicago Tribune. When he was killed, there's a famous movie, 1959, with Rod Steiger playing Al Capone and Martin Balsam playing Jake Lingle, who incidentally was Roman Catholic, or at least he's buried in a Catholic cemetery, Mount Carmel, outside of Chicago. He was no longer useful for the mob, so he was in the Illinois Central train station in downtown in Grant Park, which is where the site of the riots were in 1968. Anyway, he was down there, and two of the hitmen followed him, and as he sat down, he got a bullet in the back of his brain. And we'll try to get that clip because we used it for one of our lectures. But Lingle, when he died, they found all kinds of money in his apartment and shoeboxes, and that seems to be something that happens with discoveries that occur with Illinois politicians and media, corrupt media people. In San Francisco, we have a scandal involving a guy named O'Patrini, who's also from Illinois. He worked for the Hearst Examiner. That's when Hearst owned that paper. And then he went to work for a legal paper called The Recorder, which was part of a national legal chain. Anyway, during the Stephen Neri kangaroo court trial, he wrote a hit piece for The Recorder, and we have it, and we will put it up now pretty soon. And then we started delving into his dirty background and discovered that he got a HUD condo, at an affordable condo from HUD and through the one-time San Francisco supervisor in charge of the budget, named Terrence Hallinan, who later became district attorney, who illegally prosecuted a U.S. Navy sailor, Stephen Neri. So, and then Dennis O'Patrini no longer works for The Recorder. Then he went to work for another newspaper, and then when we exposed the condo, he sold it. However, the dirt is there. Another media, dirty media person who libeled Stephen Neri, accused him of having a gay tryst with the guy that later was killed trying to rape him, Juan Pifre, Ted Fang, who was a homosexual activist. He reportedly got $1 million from HUD, supposedly for community development. We don't know where that money went. We also had other media people. One of the people who was connected to the Chronicle, the family that owned the San Francisco Chronicle, Tirot, he got money for his bogus nonprofit, the San Francisco Renaissance, which is supposed to provide startup help for women wannabe entrepreneurs. And there were other people connected, including Juan Pifer, who ran a newspaper, who got $250,000. And then CNN has their own scandal with Julianne Malveaux, who was the cousin of Suzanne Malveaux, who was not involved in this as far as we know. Anyway, her organization got $250,000 every year. It was a black organization called Urban Economic Development Corporation, and the blacks who realized what it was referred to it as getting mine while the getting's good. And now she is she was a very outrageous person, her behavior on an airplane. She spilled coffee on somebody who was talking too loud, so she claimed. She wasn't ejected from the plane. She used to be a commentator on CNN, and then she claims to be having an economics degree, a doctorate supposedly. And now she is reportedly a president of a women's college, I think in North Carolina. And these are just a few of the media corruption personalities we have here in California and in the United States. And, of course, it goes back to the beginning of the country when after the revolution and the government was in Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia, and then went to New York, and then Washington, D.C. was set up as the capital. There were what they called party newspapers, and there's a suspected bribery as far back as the founding of this country. So it's nothing new. It's just that we're hearing more and more about it. Oh, I forgot also Lord Conrad Black. He was tried in the Seventh Circuit Federal District Court in Chicago for his manipulations with the media and corruption, and he went to prison. He's back out in the federal court. I don't know what for this time. But and how he became a lord and an American citizen is beyond comprehension, because you have to be an American to own American media interests. I think he had bought the Chicago Sun-Times, which was a field, Marshall Field, which was the big department store, which bought the Chicago Sun-Times, and then I guess they sold it to Conrad Black, and then all kinds of financial manipulation went on, and the feds intervened. So, you know, we have our media corruption over here, and it's just as bad, and it's gone on even longer than what they're accusing Murdoch of doing over in England. And, of course, there are other bribes, newspapers and magazines. There were political frauds in Germany involving one of the, I think the Willy Brandt government back in the 60s and 70s, and spies, all kinds of dirty deeds involving media people. So it does happen, and media people can be bought, have been bought, and may still be bought. Of course, Tammany Hall's description of an honest politician, and we can apply that to media people, is once purchased, once bought, they stay bought. So we will end, and we'll be back Wednesday, and we'll play the interview with we'll replay it because we played it once before. Philip Berrigan, general, not the Jesuit priest, who later went to jail during the Vietnam War, and his work on finishing or starting and finishing the American side of the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is very important and has caused a lot of problems in the Great Lakes with foreign ships bringing in these species that are not indigenous to American and Canadian waters. So we'll end to, now with our favorite political theme, politics and poker. And we'll have more interviews. I've got to work out my thing with Pat Butler and get a hold of him, so we can get an update on the best politics in the country, where it's real politics, it's not the pansy politics we see today here in California and New York. Here is old-time politics.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you five. Tony. Up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Fine,
fine. Me too.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big Ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of jacks, bat out.
Politics and poker, politics and poker, shuffle up and cards and find the joker. He's a game for children, he's a game is rough. Decisions, decisions, like
who to pick,
how to play, what to bet,
where to call up.
All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Parrot raise.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll call.
your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try, Michael, when you think of it, I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.
We could...
Well, good night. This is Pete Paul Brazola. We'll be back Wednesday at 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening. This will stay up, and you can download it later on if you want. Good night.